Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you hit the grades of your dreams at school, college, and university through the science of fast learning and lasting memory, the psychology of study productivity, and the secrets to great exam technique. And now your host, the Cambridge University trained psychologist who's dedicated his life to helping students study better and outsmart their exams, William Wadsworth.
Hello and welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast. Today we're continuing our summer When I Grow Up series about the choices you make as you go through education and what they can lead to in terms of your eventual career. Today, Dylan Morris on getting into the most competitive US universities, what it takes to succeed in academia, and figuring out what field is right for you. Dylan, a very warm welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Give me a brief introduction to what you're doing now.
So I'm currently finishing up my PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey in the US. There I work on making mathematical models of how the influenza virus evolves to escape our immunity. You may know that you have to get your flu shot every year. And one of the reasons why that is that over time, the virus's antigens, the things our body recognizes that protect us against it, change, and we have to update our protection. But we don't really understand exactly how that happens, and I use mathematical models and some real data to try to understand it better.
That sounds fascinating. And tell me where you are at the moment with your research journey.
So it's both an exciting and slightly scary time in the course of a US PhD, the fourth year, because you have one foot still very deep in the research. There are a couple manuscripts that I'm hoping to submit to journals in the next couple of weeks. On the other hand, you are starting to look forward toward the future, toward applying to jobs in the private sector, the nonprofit sector, or to postdoctoral positions in academia, and to writing up and putting together the dissertation. So there's one foot very much deep in the research, and one foot sort of looking toward the future.
Well, very best of luck with what's to come. Let's go back to the beginning. What were your first memories of the answer to the question, what do you want to be when you grow up?
So in high school, I sort of, both with some pride and some terror, would often tell people I really didn't know. I'd been very confident when I had been younger. When I was in elementary school, I knew I wanted to write books. I wanted to be a novelist. I was going to write particularly children's books. I was going to be a children's author, children's chapter books. And then in high school, you know, I still loved writing, but I realized I also really loved math and I loved science and I loved history. And I just sort of decided, you know what? I don't know. I'm going to figure this out later. And I think there were a lot of ways in which I had no idea what was going on in high school. But in this way, I knew I had no idea what was going on, and I think that was good.
Fantastic. So you became kind of, I guess, more confident as you got older about the fact that you didn't have a clue what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
What were your sort of memories of your attitude to studying at that time? Would you sort of characterize yourself as a reasonably committed student?
Yeah, so for me, there were two things. I think I had always cared a lot about doing the best job I could. I'd also done quite a bit of sport. And similar to how I was a track and cross-country athlete. And similar to how in running, I think one's always trying to push oneself, not even necessarily to do as best as well as one can relative to others, but as well as one can relative to one's own previous personal best,
yeah,
goal times. I think with school, for one thing, I always just wanted to feel that I put in my best effort. But then the other thing was I was lucky. I had good teachers and I liked school. And so the other reason I tried to study hard was I was genuinely excited about a lot, not all of my classes, but I was very lucky to have some very good teachers who got me excited about at least, I'd say, the majority of the classes I took in high school.
Yeah.
Which I realize is not true for everyone.
For the ones you were less excited about, did you have any particular ways of just kind of getting through that?
I think for me, when it was something that I thought was more boring, or when I didn't like the teacher as much, or when I didn't quite see the point of the exercise, I think my main strategy, particularly in secondary school, was to try to make that the thing I did first and put aside, and then got on to stuff that I was more excited about. By not sort of pushing off the stuff that I was less excited about, I made sure it actually got done. And then there's this real sense of freedom once you're done with the grunt work and you can move on to things that you're a little more excited about. Now, I'm not going to claim I was always good about that. I certainly, like many high school students, I procrastinated plenty. Sure. But that was usually my strategy for trying to deal with stuff I was less excited about, was to try to sort of front load that. A little bit of a dinner before dessert kind of approach.
As a There's a sort of adage in productivity, which is eat the frog. In other words, you start the day by doing something, perhaps not eating a literal frog, but doing something that's a little bit, the most unpleasant, nasty thing on your to-do list, and do that first and get that out of the way. And then it's plain sailing from there on in. So here you were in kind of high school. Where was it you ended up?
So I ended up attending Yale University in Connecticut in the U.S., and I had a really good experience there. Met some wonderful friends whom I'm still in touch with. Got to study with some fantastic professors. And because it does take a broad approach to education, in addition to courses in my chosen major, my chosen central field, I was able to take a whole variety of other things that interested me alongside. So I ended up studying a sort of combined political science, economics, maths program. But then on top of that, I was able to take courses in music. I'm a singer. I was able to take courses in history, in neuroscience. So there was an opportunity for all this almost extracurricular learning alongside my chosen focus. If anything, I would say the challenge at a place like that that offers such a smorgasbord academically is to remain at least somewhat focused on developing a central major and a central program of study.
That sounds like fantastic advice. You mentioned not kind of going too broad, but making sure you have at least some focus on a kind of, as you were saying, a core program of study. Any kind of other reflections about getting the balance right between, I guess, breadth and depth?
I think that my main reflection on that is that, and indeed one thing I do wish I'd done a bit differently as an undergraduate, is thinking very hard about not necessarily studying the courses one wants to take so much as studying the program that leads to your ideal day from 9 a.m. to midnight or whenever you go to bed in the future. There were some courses that I wish I had taken that didn't excite me so much at the time for what they themselves were, but that would have provided excellent skills for what I ended up doing for this program in mathematical biology. There were a lot of the maths I took, for example, was more on the pure math side, and because I was a little more interested in that than some of the applied math. But some of the applied math that I could have taken and that I've had to catch up on now didn't excite me as much in itself, but had applications. I guess that's why they call it applied math. That I now know really excite me. And so I think a key challenge in designing a program is to have that nice mix of the stuff that is inherently exciting and motivating to you, because that's always what you'll do best at as a student, and stuff that maybe, to cycle back to that notion of, you called it eating the frog, those courses that may not necessarily be the thing you most want to do in themselves, but that provide a pathway to things that are going to be very exciting to you in the future. Yeah. And that requires a lot of planning and a certain amount of forethought. And I think it's a lot to expect any undergraduate or any person to get it right 100% of the time, but it's still worth trying, I think, even if inevitably you'll take something that you expect to be useful and it will turn out to be useless. You'll take another thing that you're taking just for fun and it turns out to be the key to the rest of your life. Mm. And with that acceptance of uncertainty, still a little bit of the attempt to plan, I think, is a very powerful and valuable thing.
Just before we leave your undergrad days, I wonder if you had any reflections on anyone applying for a reasonably competitive US university like Yale or Princeton, where you are now. Any tips for that application process?
So I think the thing that can't be emphasized enough is that these universities at this point have so many strong applicants that one wants to put one's best foot forward, but at the end of the day, it's a crapshoot, and it's really important to remember that. Mm. Because I think a lot of students get into one selective university and not another in the United States and sort of ask, well, what did I do right with this one, and what did I do wrong with this other one? And the answer is usually nothing in both cases. What happened is you put forward a good application to both. In one, a whole bunch of coin flips came out your way, and at the other, a whole bunch of coin flips went against you. And to that end, I think the thing I encourage strong students applying to American universities, cast a broad net, find a group of universities, any of which you'd be very excited to attend, and try to put your best foot forward at each. But don't overanalyze any particular string of yeses and nos, because ultimately, it's a very random process for choosing among a large group of very qualified students. Mm. And in terms of the only advice I can give for sort of putting that best foot forward is these universities are always looking not so much for a well-rounded student who does a little bit of everything. They certainly like it if a student has a broad base of skills. But in particular, they really want to see what specific activities, ideas, possible careers, possible futures excite the student. Not so much well-rounded, as the term often is, well lopsided. A student who has a few particular interests or drives or motivations that really stand out and give them a kind of focus that's going to give them a chance to really make the most out of a place like Yale that offers so many opportunities and so many exciting things to be doing, that only a student who does have some strong sense of drive and some particular things that they're excited to take advantage of is going to really thrive in a place where they're just deluged with opportunities. So I think one thing the Yale admissions officers look for, and I imagine they do the same at Princeton and at other highly selective American institutions, is these students who don't necessarily know what they want to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but have a few particular things that really excite them. And because that gives the admissions officer a sense that that student might pursue A, might pursue B, might pursue C, but is going to have some particular angles of attack from which to dive into the massive ocean of opportunity offered by a place like Yale.
That's fantastic. I think that's really helpful. When you're preparing to talk about these areas in which you're particularly interested, is there anything you'd recommend in terms of, you know, approaches to sort of reading up on subjects and so forth that would be good to take?
So I think the key thing for any student when applying to these highly selective American universities is to first, just to think very hard about what specific things at that university they could imagine themselves diving into. So look at what unique academic programs are offered, what the unusual extracurricular opportunities are, and really do think, I mean, my view is that honesty is always the best policy. Think honestly about, if you were to end up setting foot on that campus as a first-year student, what would be the sort of three things you would be most bursting with excitement about? And then you can really structure your application around those things and highlighting in your essays and when you have an interview in the US, it's usually with an alumnus of the institution. And in talking to your secondary school teachers who are going to write your letters for you, highlighting those particular instances of a good fit, because they have so many academically qualified students that they have the luxury of choosing ones who have that particular sense of drive and that particular sense of good fit. And the more you can think about where your places of good fit are for a particular university, the easier it's going to be to craft that compelling application.
That's fantastic. No, thank you for that. So you completed your undergraduate program at Yale. What happened next?
So as I was getting to my final year at Yale, I started thinking about where I wanted to go in the future. This was now as I was starting to get the sense that I was interested in disease control and these. And I hadn't yet fully figured out at this point whether I did want to be more on the political economy side or more on the biology side. So I was looking for a lot of different jobs and also at academic scholarships. And I was very lucky and I ended up winning a scholarship to Cambridge called the Mellon Scholarship that gave me 3 years to do postgraduate study at Cambridge, not aimed at a PhD, but simply aimed at sort of more exploratory postgraduate study. And that provided me in the end with this perfect opportunity to test the waters of whether I wanted to stay more on the political science, social science, humanities side of things, or move more into natural sciences and biology. I did a master's in political thought, and I also did a master's in essentially mathematical disease ecology. And it was the latter one that really spoke to me. And on the strength of that master's and with a letter from my supervisor in that master's at Cambridge, I was able to apply to PhD programs in mathematical biology.
That led to where you are now, I guess. Again, it sounds like an amazing opportunity to have keep that breadth of study going. And, you know, that what an amazing opportunity to be able to go and spend 3 years pursuing programs of your choice and really finding out what was for you by deeply experiencing some of the different options that had interested you. That's amazing. Okay, so let's talk about the PhD a little bit then. What should people... Yep. You're right.
Yep.
Fantastic. I'll chop that little bit out. okay. So let's talk a little bit more about the PhD. So if I'm someone, you know, perhaps I'm in my undergraduate studies at the time, and I'm sort of thinking ahead and thinking I might be interested in a PhD in particularly in science, what are the sort of things I should be thinking about whether to figure out whether this is something that A is for me, and then B, you know, what should I sort of expect it to be all about?
Well, so I think that I recognize that I was extremely fortunate to get this scholarship that gave me a particularly low risk way to explore science before committing to it for a full doctoral study. And since one can't count on that, one thing that I really encourage undergraduates who think they might be interested in graduate study in biology, I supervise some undergraduates now, is to do independent research while still an undergraduate. One thing that I think is unfortunately not advertised as well as it should be to undergraduates, even at universities like Princeton with many resources and lots of opportunities for undergraduate research, is that scientists graduate students, postdocs, and professors really want undergraduate research assistants, have money to pay them, and are excited to have these people digging their hands into real working science, even at the undergraduate level. There are far more opportunities for undergraduates than there are actual undergraduates taking advantage of them, even at a place like Princeton, where we have incredibly well-prepared, ambitious undergraduates. Even so, I have to really work to get the message out to the undergraduates currently studying here that I'm happy to take on students, supervise them, give them opportunities to do research. And so my first piece of advice to undergraduates excited about science and thinking they might want to do it full time: look out for undergraduate research opportunities. Even just write to members of the faculty, write a polite email, say, are there currently any undergraduate research opportunities in your lab or any of your colleagues' labs? They may say no, but they certainly won't be offended. And they love hearing from undergraduates. And on the off chance that they don't have an opportunity for you, they may say, well, right now my lab is at capacity, but I know that my colleague so-and-so is really looking for undergraduate research assistants right now. And there are two reasons why I really strongly suggest undergraduates interested in science do independent research. The first is that there is no better ticket to getting into graduate programs than having already shown that you're capable of performing independent research, working well with a supervisor, being part of a lab community. And the letter that will come from your undergraduate advisor will be a very powerful piece of your graduate application. But the other is that if you aren't so sure whether science is for you, undergraduate courses aren't going to give you the best picture of the actual life of a working scientist. They're not going to really tell you so well whether you'd be excited about getting up in the morning and going to work. Whereas working in a lab, it won't be exactly the same as what you'd be doing as a graduate student, as a postdoc, as a professor, but it will give you a much clearer sense of what you'd be doing, not only because you'll yourself be doing research, but also because you'll be interacting on both informal and professional terms with graduate students, postdocs, and faculty members. And you'll see a little more of a window into their lives, and you'll get a better sense of whether this is a life that might make sense for you.
I think that's a hugely powerful piece of advice. There's kind of two or three thoughts of my own that kind of popped into mind as you were talking. One is, as well as the things you mentioned, it's also such a great opportunity to build relationships with people a few years down the line, or perhaps even more senior, you know, professors of several decades career experience. And, you know, at either end of the spectrum, what fantastic people to learn from and to get advice and, you know, a little mentorship from when you're still at that point in your career where you're trying to figure out all these factors about where you want to go, what you want to do. The other was just that it's perhaps even broader than just science at undergrad. Perhaps there are kind of non-science opportunities. So my final year at university was spent doing business. And I'm sure the same would be said for a lot of the professors in that discipline who were undertaking some kind of research program, you know, opportunity there for undergraduates to step in and help and get some great experience in the process. And then even before you get to university or college in the first place, one of the things I did when I was preparing to apply for science at university was I got in touch with my local university in Hull in the north of England and just said, look, I'd love to come and, you know, is there a lab I can come and sort of help out in for a few weeks over the summer? And they said, yeah, absolutely, that would be great. So I spent a few weeks learning how to operate various kinds of chemical measurement tools and having a really interesting time, and that looked fantastic on the university application. So getting involved in research, it's fantastic piece of advice.
And I think that one thing I agree completely with that you pointed out is that these opportunities are everywhere, not just in science, and not just within the academy either. I similarly would encourage, for example, undergraduates interested in law to look for internships at law firms and legal nonprofits in the summers of their undergraduate careers. I would encourage undergraduates interested in business to look for private sector internships in management in various working companies in the summers during their undergraduate careers. And I think undergraduates increasingly are aware of these opportunities, but not all undergraduates are equally aware. And I think it's very important that those of us who've been through it do advertise it, because everyone should know, because there are so many opportunities, and it's a shame for any of them to go to waste and any of them to go unfilled, because it really is a win-win for everyone. As you said, the relationships you'll build with people farther along your potential career path, following in your footsteps, and everywhere in between are invaluable and can become long, long friendships.
That's fantastic. I love it. So any other advice for potential PhD program applicants?
One thing, I can't claim to give advice that's general to PhDs, or even necessarily general to the sciences, because one thing that I'm always struck by when I talk to friends and colleagues in physics or even molecular biology as opposed to mathematical evolutionary biology is that every PhD program has its own particular norms and idiosyncrasies for what they look for in an applicant, what behaviors they expect an applicant to engage in the time leading up to the actual application. But in my field, which is the broad field of population biology, ecology, evolutionary biology, one thing that is key is making contact with a potential supervisor before you send an application. And unfortunately, it's something of an unstated norm. So there are plenty of students who send out applications to universities where they haven't contacted a potential supervisor. And even if it's a terrific applicant, that application will usually go to the bottom of the pile, because unless a supervisor is ready to say, I'm willing to take this student and I'm excited about having this student in my lab, it's going to be quite hard, at least in my field, for that student to reach the top of the pile. And so in population biology, ecology, evolution, students should contact a number of labs in which they'd be excited to work and try to set up Skype conversations with faculty members. Faculty are almost always willing to have a short Skype. Usually by the end of that Skype, they will give you a signal of whether they think it makes sense for you to apply for their lab. They'll essentially say one of three things. One is, well, this seems great. Unfortunately, I'm not taking students this year, but you might consider these other labs at my university or elsewhere. They might say, well, you seem like a very strong candidate. I do, however, have several other strong candidates this year, so you are more than welcome to apply, but it will be competitive. Or they will say, I would strongly encourage you to apply. I think this is a terrific fit. And I would really focus one's energy on the labs where you get that strongly affirmative response, but I wouldn't take the others as so damning either. They are usually honest responses, because these labs do have strong candidates. If you still think it's a great fit, that's still worth putting in an application. And as for the ones when they're not taking students, they won't just freely reel off names without thinking. They will have been listening to you describe your research interests. And these people know their own field very well. So when they say, my friend so-and-so, I think would be a great advisor for you, they usually mean it. And it's 100% worth your time then to turn around and shoot off an email to this other faculty member and see what they say.
What are the norms for my field if it's not quite the same as what you've been describing? I'm guessing a good way to find out is just kind of reach out to a couple of people in that field and ask what would be expected and how they'd like to engage.
Yeah, and I think in particular, this is another reason to work in labs as an undergraduate if you're interested in graduate study. But in general, try to look through your group of friends, find someone who is currently in graduate school or has been through graduate school in the field you're interested in, and send them a quick email asking if they'd be willing to meet for coffee, or if they're far away, have a Skype, and just walk you through how it works. And people are almost always going to say yes to that, because we didn't want to fly blind and we don't want you to fly blind. So we're always excited when someone reaches out to us and says, okay, walk me through this. How does this all work? And as you say, well, I completely agree. It's really worth finding out what the particular context, the particular norms and culture of your chosen field are, because there's a surprising amount of variation. And just getting that insider's perspective from someone who's been through it is so illuminating.
And I think, again, that's sort of fantastic advice that has applications beyond academia. And, you know, just thinking about kind of various careers I was interested in at various points, sort of from theatre to business, where I did end up, sort of a number of very competitive fields. And what I found was I could reach out to people, even people that I didn't know personally, ask for advice. And a lot of the time, people are happy to send the ladder back down if they've managed to climb into a particularly competitive area and kind of help up the next generation. It's fun for people to have those conversations a lot of the time. So don't be afraid to ask.
And not so we don't paint too rosy a picture for your listeners, there will be the occasional jerk who wants to pull the ladder back up after. But I will say that I think, and I suspect this has been your experience as well, that in competitive fields like academic science, like business, like theater, people are aware of how hard it is, how tricky it is, how many unspoken norms there are. And as a result, most people feel very grateful to be where they are and know they wouldn't have gotten there on their own. And as a result, feel almost an obligation to extend a hand and help other people who are in the position they were in a few years ago, flying blind, fly a little less blind.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right. Feels like a fantastic message to close on. Dylan, thank you so much for this conversation. I think there's been a huge amount of fascinating insight and really valuable advice in here. I always ask towards the end if there's one piece of advice you could go back and give to yourself back at high school about sort of the world of academia and study and, you know, finding your path in life, what would you say?
I think I'd go back and tell my 16-year-old self two things. Be patient and imagine your everyday day. And you can revise that everyday day. But at each point, think, okay, if I keep going where I'm currently going, what's it going to look like on a typical Tuesday when I get out of bed? What's my day going to look like? And do I like how it's going to look? And if I don't like how it's going to look, well, what should I do differently so I'm headed toward a typical Tuesday I like a little better? And the patience is important because you're not going to get to your dream typical Tuesday on the first try, I think, unless you're extremely lucky. But it's a really good exercise. And once someone finally taught me to use that exercise, and I've been using it ever since, I got it a little after 16, but it really helps focus your thinking about why am I where I am now, where do I want to be in the future, and how do I get from here to there? And that combination of dreaming about the future, but having patience about the present is a tricky skill, but if you can get it right, it can be such a valuable skill.
That's fantastic. Incredibly powerful stuff. Dylan, thanks once again. You've been an absolutely fantastic guest. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you, Will. This has been such a pleasure. And thank you to all your listeners for tuning in.
If anyone wanted to get in touch or sort of find out a bit more about you and what you're up to, where could they go?
So the best way to find me is through my department website at Princeton. You can just Google Dylan Morris, Princeton University. all pop right up at the top of the search results. And anyone interested in these questions, whether particular to biology or in general about study and considering a career in academia, should feel more than willing to send me an email at my email address, dhmorris, that's dhmorris, at princeton.edu. I always love to hear from aspiring scientists and anyone interested in this odd but wonderful world that I get to live in.
That's fantastic. Dylan, you've been incredibly generous. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Will.
Thanks for listening to the Exam Study Expert Podcast. Remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And please take a moment to write a review for our show in your podcast player.